I think I'm just personally very happy that there's a contingent of people in the world who are waiting for Adam to hook up his bidet. I think something about that is just sort of like a weird, magical 2020 moment. Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 253 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the web programmer.
I'm Sam, and I'm not a programmer.
This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is April 3rd, 2020. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity on this show, so you know.
Yeah.
So there.
That's all there is to it.
I mean, it is April Thrules Day.
Ooh. Yes.
You know, that's the third day.
It's the day where all the fools are just through with getting pranked.
Yeah. That was, for me, that was on March 31st.
Were there actually any good April Fools this year? I didn't even pay attention to it. I feel like there's a little, kind of a little bit of other stuff going on.
So, it was a lull. There was
Overwatch
a lull.
Put googly eyes on all their characters. So that is
hilarious.
That's pretty awesome. I'll give it to them. So that the gaming happened. Ones I feel like are usually the best because they're just like ridiculous.
Yeah, there was
ideas.
There was another thing that where some developer implied that they were going to take some old like 3DS or something game of theirs and put it on the Switch.
Mm.
And then people got really excited, and then it turned out that was not true. And then people got very angry.
I feel like there's a line to walk, because if your prank is like, hey, you know this thing that you love and want really bad, you can't have it.
Yeah, or we've ruined it or whatever. Yeah.
So Blizzard posted a video with – it was a trailer on the WoW channel. It was a trailer for – Burning Crusade Classic.
They posted it on April Fool's?
Yeah, but then it turned out to be a Rickroll. So, but again, this is I opened it, I was like, oh my God, yes! And I was like, fuck, it's April 1st. Yeah, okay, let's see it. I opened it up. No good.
Yeah, the only one I saw
was like the googly eyes, which is dumb.
Yeah, the only one I saw that where somebody actually got something new was there. I can't remember which studio it was, but there was some – actually, it might have been Darkest Dungeon. It was something surprising where they announced on April Fool's Day they were going to have some multiplayer DLC for a game that kind of didn't feel like it made any sense to have that. And everyone was like, obviously, this is a joke because why – you know, that's dumb, right? And it turns out they're actually doing it. Unless it's an extended April Fool's where they're going to keep on tricking you until eventually they don't actually deliver it. I guess that's possible.
You know what? The best move would be – to on one April Fool's announce that you're going to do something that sounds crazy and dumb.
Okay? Yeah.
And people and are like,
the next
ha,
April
ha,
Fool's, you've now done
you,
this.
Yeah. Next April Fool's, you do it. You release that thing.
Yep.
Because then people will be like, come on, no, this.
They talked about this last year.
This is the same joke as last year. Yeah. And then people will be like, no, man, go download it. Seriously. And you'd be like, ha ha.
Yeah, I don't trust this.
I don't think so. Oh, man, that's great. Before we get into the news, we'd also like to thank our recurring supporters from moneygrab.bscotch.net. We grab their money.
It's great.
It's great. Mm-hmm. I like it. All right, let's talk about life. Sam, you want to talk about Diana making cool paintings of stuff.
Yes. So my wife had two shows that were supposed to be happening for her to exhibit her artworks in some places.
She's a paint person.
Mm-hmm, these giant paintings that she puts together. And both of them got, you know, postponed / canceled because – what's happening these days. Life is canceled. Yes, so she ended up basically putting out a call for people to send in pictures of their at-home spaces that they are essentially, you know, quarantined in. And then she's been painting them and actually really fast. So every day she does one for like not one of a half basically and then posts it and posts a little snippet about it. And I wanted to share it because one is they've been resonating a ton just with people that, of course, that, you know, follow her already. And they're really pretty and they're really fun. And you get to, and then you see the little blurb about the person afterward. And it always kind of colors the image to a degree, you know, whether they're having a good time in quarantine, whether you know, who they know who's sick or whatever else. And it's just been a really interesting thing to see her, I think, really rapidly spin from being like, oh man, like all my shows are canceled for the next while. And all this work that I've been working on for 6 months, like a maniac, is on pause now to just within a couple of days saying, okay, how do we, you know, how do we make something good out of this and give something you know, of joy back to people. And so it's really fun to see. Really fun
this
to watch.
Is like a legit, you know, life's lemons into lemonade.
Yes.
Sort of.
Yeah. We've been scenario. Making that, yeah, we've been cracking that joke in the house quite a bit.
It's all about that pivot.
It is. Yeah. So yeah, her Instagram is Diana Zhang _. And it's just a bunch of cool paintings and stuff.
That's people are welcome Zeng.
Zhang.
People are welcome to send in their at-home workspaces, little pictures of them, and then they might show up in there. Who knows?
This sounds like a coffee table book in the making.
That's what I was thinking. It's going to be, to me, it's going to be a fascinating sort of historical document, you know?
Yeah.
I saw a note from a principal who was telling parents to, you know, see if you can get your kids to basically produce a document, you know, a journal over the course of their time doing this, because they're like, this is literally a big historical thing. And in 10, 20 years time, to be able to have this like personal record of you going through it would be kind of incredible. So
it's also a very bizarre time because of how wildly segmented the experience is for different groups of people.
Yes.
Like some people are just bored. Some people are having a really hard time, and some people are very sick.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's just there's going to be a lot of really weird sort of like retrospective stories and documents and stuff that mm-hmm. come out of this time. So it's good that people are thinking about this.
Yeah.
You know. So I'm excited to kind of see what stuff she does. I think that sounds like it's probably very helpful for people as well.
Yeah, she's got a lot of people reach out afterwards, and just they not only just like the project a lot, but then of course, you know, as we've talked about with the value of entertainment or video games or whatever else, it is useful during times like these in particular. Very useful to people. So
yeah. All right, now let's talk about the studio specifically. It's freaking April.
We've crossed the threshold.
It is the month of launch. Now, we're launching on the last day of the month, so it's, you know.
Still far away.
Still counts. But it's April 3rd.
And I mean, it's less than 4 weeks away.
Yeah. And our gold – so we call it our gold build, which is the 1.0 build that has all of the things in it that we will be releasing. So that means all the features, all the bug fixes, all the optimizations, and all of the text, all the localized translated text. So that's all done. And on April 1st, I incremented the version number to 1, mm-hmm. which was an oddly emotional thing to do because literally nothing else changed other than the number 1. It was just like 3 bug fixes and then flipping it over to a 1.0. But
well, that, I mean, walk us through what that, you know, I mean, like, what is that? Because for anybody who's not necessarily launched a game or launched a product, that's a very weird moment.
It's a big thing, you know, because it's been 2 years and 4 months that we've been working on this game, but this game represents. I feel like for us, it represents a big milestone in our studio, which is coming off of Crashlands. Crashlands was like a totally it was unreliable and unexpected, and it was like shooting from the hip, and everything was on fire, and we had no good processes in place to sort of handle having a game that actually had players and was successful, and. And the fallout from launching that game was – there was a lot of it just in terms of how it impacted our health and our sleep and how much we had to crunch to keep things going. And we also made all kinds of business blunders and just did all kinds of stuff wrong for years after Crashlands came out. Now, that's not to say we didn't do anything right. I think we did many things right, but but because of all of that, you know, it took us 4 years mm-hmm. to get this game out between Crashlands and Levelhead. And so I think for me, the emotional weight of getting this game out is – it feels like a return to like being back on top of things and being in control of things as opposed to just feeling like we're digging out from the hole that we put ourselves into. So, yeah, I mean, it was a big deal, I feel like.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm very excited.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of it's a weird thing because it's also the fact that it's going – this it's sort of the no turning back point, right? Because I think one of the things a lot of people who create stuff don't necessarily talk about is the fact that, like, when people start using it, like, that's what you're building it for technically, right? But also that's also the time when you're going to start getting plenty of feedback about it, good and bad, right?
There's a vulnerability to it.
Yeah.
You know, like you're putting that thing out there and it's going to get reviewed by critics.
Yep.
Whose job is to critique, you know? Like, yep. They will say things like you'll spend two and a half years working on a thing and, you know, they'll say things like, I mean, it's pretty good overall, but there's this one nitpick I have with it. So like 8.5 out of 10, right? which you think to yourself, you know, what about the other 99% of the game? But it just doesn't matter. You're not going to nail everything.
Yeah.
And there's always that kind of dread of thinking like, did I miss something? And the answer is yes, of course.
Yeah, I mean, there's always more that you could have done, right?
That's
just how it is.
And so we've got the 1.0 made. It's all submitted through the various cert channels, and in some cases already is approved, and in other cases is going through that approval process for all the different platforms. We've got our pre-registration page up on Google Play, which has right now 58,746 pre-registrations.
Yeah,
which sounds high. But also,
but is
we
it?
Have no no data. Is there a 0.1% conversion? Does that turn into 8 sales?
Yeah, notice that's people who want to be alerted the day of, right? That's not,
and also,
it's not sales.
There's also no price on Google Play. So people don't actually know what they're signing up to do when
they're
it
not pre-ordering.
Out. They're not pre-ordering. Yeah. It's basically wish listing, but it's wish listing for a thing whose price is unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is often the case on something like Steam. The big difference is that on Google, people expect things to be free.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So they don't know. So my assumption is that the conversion will be low.
Yeah, we'll find out.
But one interesting thing is that because the game – this is our first fully localized game, and the US is actually number 4 in pre-registrations.
Really?
So number 1 is South Korea.
Really?
And number 2 is India.
Huh.
So that one's also interesting because English is predominantly spoken in India. So it being localized actually doesn't help us
at all. That's just
an interesting coincidence. Yeah. So there's going to be some really interesting things that come out of this. We've also gotten just as of yesterday, I think, we got pre-orders opened up on the App Store as well for iOS. So everything is humming along, and over the course of the next month, you will start to see Levelhead sort of ideally, you know, exponentially creeping up in terms of awareness of how many people know about it, how many people are talking about it and stuff.
And it'll really start kicking off after the 23rd or so. It's the week,
yes.
The week running up to launch is usually one of the busiest ones in terms of various ads and stuff turn on, and a lot of our outreach actually starts for real at that point. But
the vast majority of our ad spending happens on launch day itself, which of course
is
also when all of the stores put it up for sale and make it fully available. And if they're going to do any featuring for us, that's when they do that too. So the biggest splash definitely is going to be launch day.
Yeah.
And we're actually our efforts are going to be fairly quiet really for the next few couple weeks, but then they will ramp up very dramatically.
Yeah, there'll be a few ballyhoos to look forward to, a few newsletters coming out, and then otherwise, yeah, launch itself is the next big thing, which is wild.
Yep. We're also doing some. So our work has kind of shifted this week in terms of what it looks like, because with the 1.0 done, the amount of urgent work has subsided because it's done now. Like, we can't change it, right? Mm-hmm. And so personally, I've been kind of working through figuring out how to transition from being a developer to assisting with some of the marketing efforts. And I'll be doing that over the course of the next week or so to get some things prepared. So I'm writing the the Levelhead Division Employee Manual, which will be made available kind of like what we did with the Crashlands Manual.
Do we need a separate web page for that? That's just for that purpose.
Ideally, we could also. I wanted to make a PDF so we could like have a thing you could download. You know.
Now we also talked about
we need multi-format is what we really need.
Yeah. Now we talked about having Sam read it.
Record
his narration of it so that you can have Sam as the voice of the narrator from the presentations in the game. I read you through the employee handbook. So I think that's going to be super fun.
It's something that Hades that Hades is doing in early access is every time they roll out patch notes, they have, I don't know if it's the same because I think they have a bunch of voice work done in the game. So, but it's one of the voice actors does a dramatic reading of the patch notes every time they come out, which is pretty spectacular. So yeah, I'm 100% on board with this idea.
Yeah. So we're going to do some fun stuff. What else are we doing? We're doing a welcome email, I think. So when people get their Rumpus account created through Levelhead, then we can send them an email basically being like, hey, you know, welcome to the game and here's some extra resources for you. So we can link them to the employee handbook as well as community resources like the Discord, the subreddit, Spotlights, stuff like that.
And all that.
Yeah, because we basically found that those things are super helpful for giving people just a better sense of what's out there for them to participate in around the game so that they don't just kind of like pop into the game, be like, oh, okay, this is fun, and then just wander off. So yeah, there's lots of stuff to do there. And then once that's all done, then we start figuring out like what happens after launch. Like what's our 1.1 patch? What's our 1.2 patch if we can?
I mean, the fascinating thing we've talked about this in the past, but there's this problem with achieving these big goals, which is that there's a vacuum that sort of opens up all of a sudden, right? Where all of that stuff, I mean, it's actually already happening to a degree. So Adam is the only one who's still, because he, of course, is supporting all the web systems,
which can be updated at any time.
Including during launch, which will almost definitely have to happen.
That was probably updating the website right now.
Nope. But I have updated it twice today.
He's the only one who basically is able to or has to, depending on your frame, continue development all the way up to the 1.0. And so as a result then, we're moving into this strange space where a lot of the I don't know. It's like that you enter in that vacuum space. Like you did the big thing and now you got to cross off a couple of these smaller things. But then the next question looms, which is like, well, what's the next big thing? Yeah. And even our priorities board is like our priorities board for the studio is almost like it's starting to drain down. Like we're finally, you know, finishing off a lot of these gigantic projects that have been in there for, you know, we put that board together 4 months ago or something like that. And so it's really kind of crazy.
Yeah, now, of course, we do want to begin working on Crashlands 2, but
that's we've got in a while.
Yeah, we want to make sure that we give Levelhead its due and that if the players materialize at launch, that we support the game and there's a few kind of like pie in the sky, really weird and dumb things that we've been wanting to put into the game that we just haven't been able to take the time to do because we've been doing launch prep. And so Sam and I did some planning, coming up with some really, really weird stuff to put in the game. So I don't know. Well, I mean, everything's up in the air now and we can't really commit to anything until we see what happens.
Plus, I'm pretty confident that patch one will be the patch that makes it so that our lives aren't disintegrating due to the flood of players patch. Whatever that's going to mean, but I think there's going to be something.
There's got to be something.
There's always wrinkles. Yeah. So we'll find them. They'll find us, more like.
Yeah, they'll find us. That's what's going to happen.
We just got to get steamy enough that we can't get wrinkled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right, so I think that's all the stuff that we wanted to talk about for studio news, unless you guys had any final thoughts.
Nah.
All right, let's just get on to questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Fly Hoppy Axe Rompa, who says, If you gave your wives full creative control over your next game project, but you were still in charge of the technical execution of creating that game, what would that project look like? So the three of them are the designers, essentially.
So the question really
is, we are just the hands.
What games do the three of them like, and then how do you like smash those together? So Diana is a roller coaster tycoon addict, I think is the simplest way to put it.
Yeah. I was going to say fiend, but yes.
I think she's crossed that line a couple times. So addict is the terminology. Yeah,
she's relapsing.
Yeah. Roller coaster tycoon is her jam. Bread, butter, whatever, you know, food item makes sense for this analogy. That's it. So Adam, if you had to pick one game for Jenny, what would that be in this context?
I don't think I could pick one. She plays a really diverse range of games.
What kind of game do you think she would make?
I don't know. I mean, again, because it's that diverse range of things, you know, because what she does for a living is write, but she doesn't play any, like, she doesn't play graphic, you know, like graphic novel style games or anything like that. Whatever you call
those. She's not necessarily into extreme narrative games.
Yeah, except for, of course, like the RPGs that have really good narrative content and stuff, which she's played a whole bunch of.
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of games that she just like loves the shit out of, but they're all very different from each other. So in terms of like actually – in terms of what does that mean for your artistic creation, you know?
I don't know.
I have literally – I don't know how to map – I don't think there's a mapping without somebody actually sitting down and think about it themselves of like – I don't think I can map for another person their interests onto their artistic interests and capacity, right? Mm-hmm. Because like even for my own stuff, like the kinds of games that I'm into playing are not the kinds of games I'd want to make because of –
because you want to make a game that's interesting to make.
Yeah, not right. And of course, I hope it's interesting to play too, but I'm more interested in the making it part than in the playing it part.
Because that's what your job is.
Because that's what your job is. So, yeah, I feel like they're just different things. And so I'm not, I just can't really come up with an answer to this question.
It's a tough one. I think I also have a challenging answer here because my wife is not really into video games. Mm-hmm. Sampada is a sports human. She's just always – she's been playing tennis since she was six. She was a national tennis champion in India. She does CrossFit. She plays tennis. Even now during the quarantine, she's doing 30 to 40 minutes of workouts. Today's her rest day and she woke up and she looks at her phone and she's like, ah, crap. And I was like, what? And she's like – this is going to be a great workout today. I have to do it. She's like, this is going to be so good. It's got, and then she like starts listing all the things that she is excited about doing in this workout. So she does the opposite of what the rest of us do, which is like, we're all
look for every excuse to not.
Right.
We're coming up with reasons to turn everything into a rest day. And meanwhile, she's trying to get out of rest day. And so if she were to be involved in making a game, it would potentially be something Pokemon Go-ish where like you're out and about doing stuff. But also she will absolutely destroy puzzles and Sudoku books. So I genuinely
design a puzzle? Because like designing a puzzle game is so different than playing a puzzle
game. It is so different. Yeah. And that's really the core problem is much like, you know, if you're a brewer of beer, I don't know if that means that you're going to always make the kind of beer that you like to drink.
Right.
Or are you just going to make – or do you like to do experiments with your brewing? And like some of it other people might like that you made and – you'll just keep making that because people like it, right? It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell where things go on the creative side. It's almost
like we stumbled on this problem, which is that your personal interest is what you find as entertaining as a piece of media might be completely different from what you find basically fulfilling to make as a piece of media.
Or that you're capable of making.
Yeah, that's a whole other question.
Because every MMO player wants to make an MMO, but – There's a reason that only a few MMOs exist, you know? Mm-hmm.
Because apparently it takes more than one person to make
somehow.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my – so MMOs are my jam. And I've always wanted to make one, but also I realized that in order to do that, I would need to be running an organization of probably over 100 people.
Yeah, at least scale.
You need scale, and you need a constant 24/7 customer support. You know, you need, because people are playing your game 24 hours a day online. And so if something goes wrong in the game, like maybe somebody gets stuck in a wall, like this does happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you need a GM to come in and get that person out of the wall.
Yeah.
Because that's just how you do it. So it's very hard to make the things that you like sometimes. All right. Next question comes from Butterscotch Atheist. Thoughts on looking at other games' game reviews? For example, have you looked at the reviews for the Mario Maker series to make sure you don't make the same mistakes they did?
Interesting. Yes, but I think reviews, ideally what you can find is actually someone who is not necessarily critiquing the game, but someone who is more so just like excitedly
trying to understand it.
Yeah, trying to understand it. Yeah. And saying like, oh, I played this, like honestly the best video for us was the Steve video. The video by Steve called The Play Problem. And we saw that and we were like, oh, we can solve that problem. And this is the issue of, you know, in any user-generated content game, how do users who generate the content actually get other people to see it? Which is, you know, the most exciting part about all of that, without having to be famous external to the game. And the fact that, you know, in a Mario Maker 2's case, like they did not solve this problem. In fact, Levelhead, I believe,
didn't
is the
even
first
try.
Yeah, Levelhead is the first basically maker game that actually tries to solve this problem to make it possible for anyone, no matter what, to actually be able to get their stuff seen by other people and played.
And, now, I also want to say that, you know, we've said in the past that if you read reviews written by even professional game critics, oftentimes the review reveals more about the person doing the reviewing than about the game.
Yeah.
And people who leave reviews are rarely that self-aware that they write the review in a fairly objective, more like sort of standardized way. Like they don't evaluate the game. They evaluate how they felt about the game, right? Mm-hmm. And so and negative reviews in particular often have people coming into games with outrageous expectations and demands of what they wanted the game to be, and the game just wasn't that thing, right? And they gave it a thumbs down. Or you have people coming in who end up getting into a game and give it a positive review despite potentially having a large number of bad experiences getting into the game early, which they've mm-hmm. sort of since forgotten about by the time they get to hour 100, and their review is not reflective at all of what is actually causing people to quit the game, for example,
right,
or whatever. So I don't know. I think that reviews – I personally like to just myself pick up a game and play it. Like if there's a competing game like what we had with – when we first started working on Levelhead and picking up Mario Maker, we just picked it up and played it and talked about it, right?
Well, this kind of goes to that question from last week about, like, you know, do you play games on purpose basically for work reasons? And this is the category of stuff where it's like, oh, how did they do, you know, X, Y, or Z, and go check it out yourself. I think the danger of relying on reviews is if the reviewer is more about the sentiment behind the effect of a design decision versus what that design decision is and how it affects the gameplay. That's the sort of stuff that's really useful and really fun, where it's like, oh, in Steve's case, here's this interesting issue with, you know, how this game's made. Or here's how this works in a really useful way. But it's very rare to find someone who articulates that super effectively. So I find like Game Maker's Toolkit has been really useful. There are a couple other YouTube channels that I look at. Whenever they put out a video, I'll just watch the whole thing because it's very fun to see someone skillfully articulate how various pieces of design kind of fit together. But I don't necessarily think you get that per se on a review side. And I think critical reviews.
Yeah, you do on occasion, but it that's one of those rare gems where it's very particular reviewers who are just extremely thoughtful and also took a lot of time with the game and studied it and are – because the cool position that a reviewer is in, a professional reviewer is in, is they've seen a lot of stuff. You know, yeah. They've got their pulse on what people are into in the moment. They've seen fads come and go. If they've been around for a while, they've written about a whole bunch of stuff. And so they've seen the technology change and they've seen new design ideas come into being. And, mm-hmm. and so they have a huge, in principle, they have a huge awareness of what games are all about. And that
puts, they've had the opportunity to acquire a huge awareness.
Well, but most of their most of their awareness for most reviewers is the player style awareness, right? Where they can tell how the thing feels. They've been exposed to stuff, and so there's more stuff that they sort of can realize. There's more stuff that they can respond to, but mm-hmm. still, most of it I think is sort of implicit and doesn't end up creating a lot of really careful analysis of that thing because it's not – there's not a self-aware component of the same thing.
It's true that it's not necessary for that role, right? Which is that the main thing that you're looking for when you go to read a game review
is this going to be a good time?
Yeah. It's like a yes or no. Like, does this person I trust who generally recommends games, who I've played some of their games, do they say it's good or not? And that does honestly, come down to a gut feel thing. So I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with not providing some of those like more interesting breakdowns. It's just that for us as the devs, they're not as useful unless they include those elements.
Yeah, it needs to be a breakdown for it to be really useful. Otherwise it's just sort of a vague report of kind of how somebody felt about it. I mean, and every once in a while you'll see something in even a pretty lightweight review where there's like a particular design choice that they hate or whatever. Mm-hmm. That we can see and be like, oh yeah, like we're also doing that. Let's rethink that now that just because we just saw somebody hating it, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's the only kind of thing you can really get out of a regular review as a developer.
Now I'd also point out that I think we're all thinking about this in terms of negative stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Because interestingly, like there are tons of fantastic, well written, positive reviews out there that really like go into great depth about why they love the game. And those, I think, are actually pretty useful a lot of times. It's just that we have a tendency to look for the negative reviews and seek them out because generally speaking, like if we're interested in making a certain kind of a game, then we feel like we have a sense of what's cool about that and what's fun about that type of a game. Mm-hmm. And we may look at reviews to get a better sense of what people are looking for, but generally we already know what we want to do with the game.
Yeah.
And so really it's we seek out the negative reviews to try to figure out where we might accidentally go wrong. But like we've been saying, it's oftentimes hard to parse out what is a legitimate complaint versus an idiosyncratic complaint. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Next question comes from Tim Conceivable. Adam,
what?
With the TP shortage of 2020, are you going to finally hook up that bidet?
I'm going to need to because we're winding down in our toilet paper reserves. So that's probably going to have to happen really this weekend before we run into trouble. So
now I knew this was coming because I was reading. I mean, this. If you've been paying attention to world news, and of course you knew what was happening in China just in November and December, mm-hmm. right? And I was reading an article and somebody had made a comment in there and they were like, the strangest thing about all this is that you cannot find toilet paper in the stores anywhere. And it makes no sense. Why? Why are people out there buying all of the toilet paper? Yes. And I think it's because people think to themselves, I might need to be in my house unable to go get supplies for a couple of weeks, right? And because toilet paper is replaced so rarely that generally people have literally no concept of how much of it they use.
Yeah.
And so they just get a lot of it just to be safe. And then you have this reinforcement loop, right? Like you see that the toilet paper's half gone and you're like, oh, fuck, I don't really need toilet paper, but if it's going to be gone, I don't want to be without it. So I should probably go get some, yeah. Right?
Well, I think also the consequence of actually running out, if you've ever been on the toilet and then realized that the roll is empty because someone fucking bamboozled you.
it's a dire situation.
Yeah. No good. Yeah.
So you don't want to be caught in that, right? And so I remember I read that article, and then as soon as the GDC cancellation hit, I was like, I gotta go get some toilet paper. And so I actually have here in my storage room, I have one extra 18 pack ready to go.
You're one of those hoarders. You're part of the problem.
It's in my basement.
A single 18 pack. You're terrible.
Yeah, monster
and all that.
So I didn't hoard, but I did just get one backup pack, you know.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, because again, like you said, Sam, I don't want to be caught
You don't want to be caught with your pants down, you know.
Right around the time all of these ding dongs started buying up all the toilet paper, myself included, all the bidets sold out.
Yep. Yeah, that is also true.
If you go online, try to look at the bidets.
Gone.
All the bidets are gone.
I think I'm just personally very happy that there's a contingent of people in the world who are waiting for Adam to hook up his bidet. I think something about that is just sort of like a weird, magical 2020 moment to me, you know?
I mean, we got the bed jet review. Now we need the bidet watch.
The bidet jet review. Yeah, really. I'm just honestly going to have to – I almost hooked it up last weekend, but last weekend I was just weirdly tired for some reason, like the whole weekend. So I kind of just did nothing. But we're at that point now where I think it basically has to happen this weekend.
It's time.
So let's.
We've talked on the podcast about Dominion, right?
What about it?
Just about the fact that I've had this board game for 4 years and never opened it. Mm-hmm. I feel like the bidet is starting to enter that. That territory.
You gotta be careful. If you wait any longer, it's gonna be tradition that you talk about it every week.
Once per year, we talk about it. Talk about Adam hooking up his bidet, and then he doesn't hook it up. Okay, well, I guess maybe next week we'll hear the wonders.
I'm sure it'll be a saga. Yeah,
of having your butt squirted with water. So dumb. All right. Next question comes from C. Price. What are your views on post-launch business models in indie games? I've been having some discussions lately on what the best business model is for an indie game to support itself after launch. My teammate's opinion is that adding microtransactions is a cardinal sin for an indie developer and will inevitably create a huge backlash. Subscription services don't work outside of MMOs, leaving only paid DLC expansions as viable. Have you seen any of these or other models work successfully?
I mean, I think you've probably seen all of the models actually work successfully.
Yeah, totally.
To one degree or another. I think what you have a taste for and what fits with your design is sort of where the trick comes in. It's easy, for example, to look at subscriptions and say like, the Apple Arcade is a good example of this. You know, they were like, we have a bunch of weird games, like a bunch of weird games that normally wouldn't be able to like fund themselves. But the reality is if it's a subscription service, you need games that make people keep coming back and playing forever, right?
Yes. You need deep games.
You need deep games. So they can be weird, but they need to be actually deep, not one-off experiences. And so really you have to pick the business model that matches with whatever the thing is. And I think the one that's not on the list, which I personally find very interesting – and I'm most curious about is not DLC, but actually the continued update model with just a premium game, which
Terraria style.
Yeah, has been the case for a number of games. Basically, when they hit some level of escape velocity in the market, then
Kerbal Space Program.
Yep. Then when they do an update, it is such a big deal that it brings in a fresh wave of players, right? And every time they do one, it brings in another wave of players. And if they're all of the games that share this in common, at least ones that I'm familiar with, are all these long form hobby games. So stuff like that you can just keep on playing, like Terraria or Kerbal Space Program, whatever else.
Armello
does that, yeah. And so I think that's the thing I find an interesting other model here too, which is this sort of just the continued update model and then trusting those updates to be essentially, you know, miniature launches of a currently existing product, relaunch and relaunch and relaunch. Yeah, over the course of years.
Well, this is a debate that we actually have constantly over and over about – and this was true even leading up to the launch of Levelhead, of what model to use for the game period. And was still part of the discussion before once we settled on that, there was still that question of what do we think we're going to do for post-launch updates? And we had a lot of back and forth about introducing potential IAPs, introducing DLCs. And I don't think – I know I personally am not – I'm not sort of settled on that I think we're doing the best thing by any stretch.
I think on some platforms we're clearly doing the worst thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like hands down.
On mobile. Yeah. We're doing the worst thing. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I think the thing to consider with – because I think Sam is right that you know, the long-term just constant free updates thing. I'm actually – and so he and I are the ones who have always been arguing about this because we're just – we just believe the opposite things basically because mm-hmm. I don't buy that free updates. First of all, I think it's only possible for a game that's already wildly successful. And I haven't seen it in any other context where a game was not successful. There's been like one or two sort of exceptions to this, right? But almost never has a game that failed
just updated its way to victory.
And so I think if you're successful enough that it doesn't matter, like Terraria is so successful that it wouldn't
just announced 30 million units sold.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah. So it just doesn't matter if it doesn't matter if they keep on putting out free updates because they're doing fine. Right. Because my bet is that if they were to do paid DLC, that the attach rate on that for Terraria would be very high and they would do a fuckload better. Making more money.
It's not that they're doing the best business model. It's just that the one that they're doing has made them $500 million. So it's
exactly. Yeah, right. And for us, that's basically the same deal with like going on a mobile with a premium title, which is not because we think that's the best model. It's because we're trying to juggle all these different platforms and we think we can get away with it. And we didn't want to have to make the changes to the game that we required to make it actually fit the IAP model that actually does work on mobile. And so when it comes to the free updates thing, I think it's one of those things that it does help keep players engaged and coming back, like your existing players.
Yeah, definitely.
But to me, that's the same thing as a DLC does, right? The difference is there's no hurdle when it's a free update. But with a DLC, there is a hurdle, except that hurdle comes with you as the developer getting paid for all that extra work that you did, right? Mm-hmm. And without a doubt, if you have a fairly rare release cycle, because if you're doing continuous updates, I don't think anybody gives a shit at all, actually. But if you do like fairly rare, larger patches.
Like every 4 to 6 months or something.
Yeah, it's like every quarter or more rarely, right? So that's a big enough deal that you can then re-engage your player base and you can use whatever tools you've developed to tell your people that you've done some cool new stuff, get some people to write things again, get some new feature treatment from all the stores. Because the stores also re-feature you if you put out an update. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's like putting out an update by itself does nothing except cost you a bunch of development money. And if you have what you need to really leverage that to get basically store featuring, then I think you can successfully turn that into new sales. But I still have a hard time buying that would be more effective than doing a paid DLC. Because a paid DLC gives you all of that same stuff, except also people pay for it, which is
– I think for me the most surprising one is Monument Valley, which is a 45-minute game.
Yep.
They released a paid DLC, which did spectacularly well.
Yeah.
People were like, fuck yeah, I want 45 more minutes of this.
And their DLC and was like $4. I think because the main game was like $4 and the DLC was also like $2 or $4 on mobile. Yeah,
So I think arguably just selling the game and never monetizing it again is clearly the second worst business move. The worst would be to just give it away for free and not monetize it at all.
The very important note there, and this is something that Adam mentioned, but I think it's worth doubling down on, is that if it's the case that doing your update allows you to get additional store featuring, then that's actually not true, right? Because the update itself is a mechanism by which you generate additional sales.
Right, except but then your goal there, because it is actually – now you have kind of a perverse incentive. Exactly.
Possible.
Yeah, you want to get the smallest update you can get that'll cause a store to feature you because you're not – because existing players don't cause you to make more money, right? Unless they are, by word of mouth, basically selling your game and you re-engage mm-hmm. them so effectively that you get a huge flood back and then that 1% conversion rate basically turns into something. Yeah, I think that's totally true.
Well, yeah, but if we think about – if it's not a question of whether something is good or bad. It's a question of whether it's the best or the worst. And I think the
– Do you mean that's the question that was asked, or that's – you're saying, well, no, globally that is the question?
This is the question when it comes to like releasing an update for free versus selling an expansion. Is selling an expansion can get you featuring and therefore new players.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Because some big expansion pack came out and that's a big deal.
But also a store is much more likely to feature you if you can make them money, which, you know, that's right, how –
which they would like an
expansion. They're going to get their 30% cut of that DLC that you're putting out.
And so it's very possible that you will get more exposure and more money by selling an expansion, and your existing players still get plenty of content and everything, and everything is great. So I personally think that probably the most successful model for an indie would be that model of selling expansions. But I also am just going on a hunch here. I don't have data for that.
But I also think the important thing with all this though is that I still firmly believe that none of this matters if your game isn't already pretty successful.
No, yeah, you can't sell an expansion for something that people haven't bought the first
time. No, and you can't update your way to a successful title by giving away stuff for free either. I mean, again, it's happened on very rare occasion, but if you look at those cases, if you look at those cases where it has happened, and look at the sheer amount of development money and time that went into pulling that off,
The main issue is actually again kind of what we experienced in early access, right? That's essentially what early access actually is, right?
You're trying to update your way to victory.
Yeah, you launch and then you try to update your way to victory. And the reality is that if people
don't bring any new exposure in early access.
Because news doesn't necessarily care and the platforms don't necessarily care. So right. That's unless you're already successful, which is the whole fucking problem in the first place.
Yeah, right? Almost all the titles that were successful coming out of early access were ones that were successful going into early access.
Yeah.
There's those very rare cases where there's always a story. There's always an explanation for those where it's like some huge streamer picked it up or, you know, whatever, something happened in early access. But it's just not really the case that like you put an early access title out that nobody knows about and you just keep chipping away. And then come launch day, everything's fucking great.
Which is why we are not counting on our early access presence as being anything meaningful when it comes to the full launch.
Well, if anything, we're assuming it's actually harming our launch.
It's very, very likely harming our launch based on everything that we've seen so far. But that's why we're launching in seven places at once, you know?
Yep.
The thinking is that the sheer presence of the game on all these platforms and the featuring across the board will allow each platform to boost the others.
Yeah, we're hoping to overwhelm all the damage that early access has done to our Steam. Yes.
Or at the very least, whelm it.
Yeah, at least whelm it so we can kind of erase some of the mountain that we've stuck in front of ourselves by going early access.
Yeah. Now, as a side note, if anybody is wondering about going into early access, probably don't.
You're right. I didn't hear you say.
Oh, I said if anybody's wondering about going into early access, don't. I think the one advantage it gave us was it allowed us to cultivate a small player base that was giving us feedback throughout the development process, and it allowed us to make a better game, which I think is true.
Yeah.
But it came with so many disadvantages.
We could have done that. We still could have done early access outside of the Steam ecosystem.
Yeah, we could have just done a closed beta and just kept that running throughout development. And so we actually gained nothing but lost a lot, I think. So
I think over that whole – because now it's been in early access for a year. And I think over that year we earned back like a month of development cost or something.
Yeah.
Something like that, right?
It's not gone stunningly well.
No, and then because of, we were in early access, that it's made our marketing really weird because the game's already technically out. Since Steam suppresses early access titles, then our game looks like it's doing worse than it actually is, because it is actively being suppressed. It turns out also coming out of launch, like we didn't know, but we can't be in the listing of upcoming games on Steam.
Because we already were coming soon a year ago.
Because we're already out. And so there's that now that featuring opportunity prior to launch that we don't get to participate in. And there's a little bit of just kind of a dampening of the sort of launch excitement, I think, that comes out of this, because we're even talking about, like, for the press stuff, having embargo dates and all of this, and it's all really weird because the
we can have an embargo.
We're going to have an embargo, but the embargo is basically for, like, the reviews, right? Because you can already go play the game. And so it's just – there's already a year's worth of
YouTube videos already out there.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is of anything that we've done throughout the development of this, the early access thing has definitely just added an endless series of wrinkles and issues to the whole process. Well,
it's made things much more complicated, but I think the inverse is also true, which is if you think about a scenario under which Levelhead early access launch was a phenomenal success, then you end up back in a scenario where that becomes a more interesting part of the story and becomes extra useful for it. I think it's sort of problematic to just say that early access is bad, because to me, it has all of the things we're describing are just the same as launching a goddamn game in the first place.
I think if you have a game that succeeds in spite of all of the dampening effects of early access, then it stands to reason that it probably would have done just fine if you had saved it for a full launch. And so I don't know if you could say that you necessarily gained anything by putting it into early access.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, though, because I think the reality is the game is very different than it would have been had we not been in early access. So I don't know if we're talking strictly business or if you're talking about the game, because I think the reality
is I'm talking business.
Yeah, I think from a monetary perspective, yeah, it's dumb. But I think it's also the question of like if it's the case that this allows us to actually achieve a much tighter product market fit by the time the game comes out on everything, then it very well may be that it is 100% worth it, despite the fact that it appears to be definitely not worth it from a business perspective.
Well, I think the alternative, though, is we could not have the business harm, but still get all that benefit by running our own early access system. Yes. That's because the key to it is the openness. I think the openness is where the problem comes from, because what removes the excitement and all that stuff. Yeah, so I think for our next title, probably we should come up with a really interesting closed early access model that maybe would still be paid. I don't know how we would do it. Maybe you pre-buy what will eventually be your Steam key or, you know, whatever, right? Or maybe it's just a free program and we cycle people in and out. Like, who knows? But I think if we can come up with a really interesting way to do early access and then do it ourselves so we can bypass all of the negative impacts that we get in the press and in the storefronts, that would be – it'd be an interesting thing to try.
But still get the feedback loop of having
players. Because if you think about because we've got basically a few thousand players in Levelhead through early access. And so that's not that many people, actually, you know? But the amount of really great feedback and sort of the depth of community that's been created as a consequence and how much more fun it was for us to do development when there were people actively engaged.
It's been so good.
Yeah, it's been like as an experience, mm-hmm. it's been fucking wonderful. It's just not as a business experience. but like the point that we can get that with actually a pretty small user base is to me the signal that we don't need to go through some enormous entity like Steam to get all those benefits. So we should.
Provided you can somehow draw them in yourself, which now that we've done our ads and stuff, I'm like, yeah, we can.
Yeah, we can do it.
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Next question comes from VooVoo987. Who says, Seth, you went on a quest for gains a few episodes ago. A few hundred, probably, at this point.
I think you've gone on a few quests for gains over the lifespan of the podcast.
I've gone on two definite ones, and on the third one, I got pneumonia almost immediately, and I couldn't complete my quest. VooVoo says, I am currently trying to get into a quest for loss. Do you have any tips? P.S. I love this podcast. Keep up the good work. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Tips on loss. People always focus on exercise. It is about food.
Yeah, it is 100% about food.
It is 100% of – you could not lift a finger and lose 500 pounds. I mean, if you've got them.
If you have – yeah.
Because weight loss is literally – it's a thermodynamics problem. Right, energy cannot
take more energy than you use.
Yeah. So everything that you've got on your body that you don't want to be there is something that you put there at some point, right? So I think the reason that this is so fucking hard is because you have to get comfortable with being kind of hungry.
Yeah, but you don't have to be really hungry, you know, because
I'm just kind of hungry.
Yeah, to me, the sort of the crux of it is awareness and like conscious awareness of what you're doing with food, because food for us, certainly as Americans anyway, and certainly as Midwesterners in particular, is kind of just this like mindless thing that you just kind of are always participating in, you know?
It's a lot more like a hobby than a survival thing.
But it's not even really – because a hobby is something you still usually think about, you know, mm-hmm. to some extent.
That's true.
Yeah,
it's just a habit.
Yeah, it's just a habit. And so I think the first thing to focus on is just conscious awareness of what you're actually doing and paying attention to how you feel from a fullness perspective, because people always eat until they're full instead of eating until they're not hungry, which are very different. Those are enormously different levels.
Yeah, you don't need
eat
to
until
be
you're
full.
Not hungry. Yeah, you can eat literally like a fifth as much if you only eat until you're not hungry than you do if you eat until you're full, and you feel way better. So there's that. And the other thing is to play the long game, because if all you do is just eat like literally 100 calories less every day, given like 5 years, you can be right where you want to be. You know, like,
mm-hmm. Well, but again, but you have, it can't be 100 calories less than what you've been doing.
It has to be, it has to be less than what you need to sustain. Yeah. But
then your maintenance level. Yeah.
Yeah. The point still being though, that it doesn't take very much actually to get a sustained, slow, healthy loss.
If you can thing is
put up with the fact that you shouldn't be even measuring it. If you just like, and to me, that's the beauty of it is if you just say like, I just want to be healthier and then eat better to be healthier, and that's all you did, then given 1 to 5 years, you'd basically have lost everything you want to lose.
Yeah, I think the tricky bit is, of course, is always the how, right? And so, I mean, there's been studies that show that if you just keep a food journal, so just keep on doing what you're doing, but just write down everything you eat. Don't even try to change it. Just write it all down.
Don't even write down the nutrition or calories. Or just write down the things that you ate.
Just keep track of it.
Yeah, literally, make it easy.
As soon as you do this, because it points – it's a mindfulness exercise essentially. It makes you aware of what you're doing. If you start doing this, then I mean there's been a bunch of studies that show that like this is one of the most effective ways to start basically getting control of this and getting the loss you want, because you suddenly become aware of it. It turns training mindfulness.
Right? Turns it from a habit into a decision.
Yeah.
I think the other thing about it is people tend to fail to realize how the math works with these things. So let's say like using Adam's example, let's say you are operating at 100 calorie deficit. Over the course of a year, you will lose many pounds. It's going to take a while, but like you'll lose the weight. But let's say you go Sunday through Friday is your 100 calorie deficit, and Saturday is your cheat day. Okay, which people often do this concept of a cheat day. So for their cheat day, they're just going to slam down a fucking giant pint of ice cream or something, which by itself may have 600 calories, right? Mm-hmm. So you're down 100 calories Sunday through Friday. So that's 600 calories. Then you have the one pint, which puts you then at a 600 calorie surplus. And now you've exactly undid the previous 6 days of work.
Which is why it's all about sustainability. Like, cause
sustainability, lifestyle change.
Yeah. Cause if it's hard for you to do, I think this is the problem. Is people always are like, I need to go on a diet. I need to only eat salads. I need to do whatever, all these extreme things. Now I need a cheat day to recover. If you literally just eat less, and not like a lot less, just eat less.
You can eat the same stuff you've been eating.
Yeah.
Just less of it.
Yeah. And that's the thing is focusing, as Sam said, like write down the stuff that you're doing as you eat so that now you're keeping a record. And then if you look at that every evening, you're like, the first few times you do that, you're gonna be like, fuck, that was a lot more than I thought it was.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is if you just, as you're eating, you just chew slowly and are constantly checking in with yourself every time you take a bite and asking, do I need this? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, just put it down. It's remarkable how many things you can just put away, you know? Like we're always trying to
once
clean our plate.
It,
once you're thinking about it. Yeah, that's the trick. It's simple but not easy, which is, I think, the tremendous difficulty.
But it's hard as fuck. Yeah. So as far as like a tangible stuff, so yeah, food journal definitely is useful. I in the past have used an app called Lose It, which is a mobile app that has like a little scanner, and you can scan barcodes and it'll automatically put the calories and nutrition information into your phone, which is super, super nice. And there's like pretty much everything is in there. And you can also put in your current weight and everything else and your activity level, age, all that stuff. And it will tell you what you need to maintain your weight and what you would need to say like lose a pound a week in terms of calories and stuff like that. So those kinds of things are super useful, I think. So
yeah, this could be helpful. I think I would my suggestion is to try some of those things just to see, but the main thing to focus on is mindfulness, because that changes your habits. And it's really all 100%. About it is just about habits.
Being aware of yep. what it is that you're doing. Yep. And so yeah, don't stress about the exercise. Exercise is great for your health.
Yeah, that's how you keep your heart from exploding yeah. when you turn 60.
But food is what you need to focus on for your weight.
Mm-hmm. And so, also your health.
And your health.
It's just more important.
Which are correlated, but yes.
Yeah. No, I think food is just more important. Like, exercise is important, definitely. Food is just actually more important.
Yes. That's 90% of it at least. Yeah. All right. Final question of the day comes from _RompyYerbly, who says, cliche question of the day. You are each stuck on an island. Different islands. I'm sorry. For the rest of your lives, and you can only have one book, one alcoholic beverage, and play one video game. What do you choose? Note, you have unlimited battery/energy and internet for your beach computer/console.
If I have unlimited power available on this fucking island.
Unlimited power.
Then all I need is a book on electronics.
The densest engineering book that yep. there is.
Give me a manual. And in 10 years time, it'll be like a, I don't even know it. What's that? Atlantis. It'll be like a fucking thing that'll come out of nowhere.
They didn't specify how many natural resources you have at your disposal. Like, could you mine for ore? You know, is this?
Does it matter if you have unlimited batteries? I got unlimited batteries.
Yeah, but you can't build. You can't build electric. You can use the batteries to power things, but you can't use them to build things that you power.
Actually, though, but you already have the internet. So, like, I guess is the internet only for the video game?
Sounds like it. Yeah.
So we have to play the game or just go with these restrictions. You know. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
So yeah, basically, it's that what book can you entertain yourself with for a very long period of time?
None.
Yeah, I can't think of a single none. One.
I would like instead just a very large sheaf of paper. Is it a sheaf? Is that what it's called?
Sheaf of paper.
Just the biggest stack of paper I can get that would be roughly equivalent to whatever the biggest book is that I would get. That's what I need.
Draw on that until you run out or something?
Just write on it, draw on it, doodle on it, whatever. It'll take me much longer to do that than to read whatever the book of that same size.
You could also use the batteries as pencils to write in the sand.
There you go.
You know?
Now, what's your alcoholic beverage of choice?
Peanut butter whiskey, probably, I think.
I feel like I would end up with too much of that.
You're going to be so mad. You're going to be so mad when I tell you the correct answer.
What is the correct answer?
Mouthwash.
Ooh. That's true. Presumably there's no hygienic supplies and your teeth are going to fall out.
Can you wash your body with mouthwash?
You can wash anything with mouthwash. You're going to be minty as fuck.
You can also use it to sterilize things. So if you get like wounds and stuff, you know?
Dang, Seth, that's good.
And they can also do that with just regular alcohol too.
It's not the best beverage. Well, it says it's an alcoholic beverage. And I feel like mouthwash is the closest thing you can get to a cleaning thing that's also technically could be a beverage, but shouldn't be.
But this is interesting though, because if mouthwash is just an alcoholic beverage that is really bad for you if you drink too much of and doesn't taste
like all alcoholic beverages
all that good, you know, then why not just and it does this, like the only reason that it freshens your breath is because there's mint in there, you know. So mm-hmm. you could just get some minty booze.
It's true. Then you have to worry about, you know, if you'd ever want to drink your.
That's just what mouthwash is.
How come you're not supposed to drink mouthwash, though? Is that because it's booze or because there's something really bad? I think it's because there's something really bad.
It's not just because it's booze. Also because the actual alcohol content is so low that it's not actually booze.
There's probably more sugar in it than there is alcohol, I would bet.
I don't think there is sugar in mouthwash.
Yeah, there wouldn't be sugar. There wouldn't be sugar in mouthwash.
I bet there is.
That's crazy, Adam. It's crazy.
I bet there is, but it's in there. It's probably just syrup with like 2 drops of alcohol.
All right. So the answer is some kind of extremely dense engineering book so that you can use your unlimited energy for your video game console to sort of Tony Stark your way off the island.
Yep. I'm getting off this rock.
Okay. Mouthwash or some other minty alcoholic drink.
Uh-huh. So you feel like you've got fresh breath.
So you can infreshen your breath and infreshen your pits. Your armpits.
Yeah.
Because it's going to smell like a human on this island real fast unless you're minting your way out of it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Final piece of the question is what video game do you choose to pass the time on this island?
You need something you can dump just thousands of hours in.
Yeah, it's got to be in something social because assuming – well, it's something that could either be social or not because it's not clear if we actually get to use the internet strictly for this purpose.
You do have unlimited internet. Presumably, this is only for the video game. So it's kind
of – I would go with Minecraft, which is not because I love Minecraft, but because it is basically infinite in the kind of like – how much you could play it, and if it's multiplayer, mm-hmm. then people are doing stuff like putting, you know, entire libraries of actual books inside of Minecraft.
Oh, I see you getting into the internet through Minecraft.
We're going to play – exactly. So I'm going to – and then we don't even need that dense as fuck book anymore, that electronics book, because I could get that in Minecraft. And then the only book I would need is one that's just fun to hold physically, which I don't actually really care about in books, so I wouldn't even take a book. Actually, I'd take a Kindle.
Yeah, you know? And you know that Minecraft is going to be around for a long time.
Yeah.
Because it has been around for 10 years and it's just keep getting Microsoft.
Bigger. More libraries will be put in it.
Yeah, because it's Legos, right? Like it can't die anymore. So, I mean, that would suck if you picked a game that, you know, like if I picked WildStar back in 2015.
Oof, that's tough.
Yeah, and, 6 months later, I got no games to play on my little island. So, all right, Minecraft. Minty booze and engineering book. I think that's good.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to everything you could ever dream of. Thank you all for listening. See you next week.
Goodbye.